Hey, Rolando.
Way to copy my cold open.
Yeah, this is yours, yeah. Do you love a good mystery?
Do I love a good mystery? I don't love a good mystery.
You don't?
I don't.
We are actually talking about the Netflix reboot of Unsolved Mysteries.
Unsolved Mysteries, yes.
And we have a special guest with us today, the host of Crime Lines podcast, Charlie Worrell. And I think it's going to be really exciting. So I think we should just jump into it because I think we're going to have a great discussion.
I love it. Let's get into it. Let's talk murder.
Let's do it. I'm Nicole.
And I'm Rolando.
And this is Remakes, Reboots, and Revivals.
An original podcast.
About unoriginality. I am so excited because today we have a special guest, someone whose podcast I've been listening to for a long time. We have Charlie Worrell of Crime Lines podcast.
Hi, thank you for inviting me on the show. I was really excited to have the opportunity.
I was telling Charlie before the show started, I've been listening to her since her podcast before this, Insight, which you could still find, I think, on podcast platforms like Spotify, I found it on, and Apple Podcasts, and you can still find her current podcast, Crime Lines. So check her out. Charlie, I just wanted to ask, you know, why true crime? Why did you want to do these two podcasts?
I've always been interested in true crime. It goes back generations in my family. So my great grandmother was from Ireland, and she was poor and illiterate. So she'd have her children read her like those true detective magazines. So then my grandmother grew up reading true crime. So that's what she read. So that's what my mom read. Court TV was on all the time in the background when I was growing up. So it's just kind of something I've always been interested in. Got into podcasting and decided to go ahead and try a true crime podcast, since that is, you know, what I'm spending my late nights looking up anyway. I might as well turn it into something.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Actually, you know, true crime was always on in the background. Today we're covering Unsolved Mysteries. Was that something that you had on in the background a lot?
Yeah, I am. So I'm a little on the old side. So I watched the original Unsolved Mysteries when I was a kid. Then when I was a teenager, they'd play the reruns on Lifetime, but like 11, midnight, whatever, on the East Coast, super late. And I would come home from, I'd go to school, I'd go to work, I'd come home, and I would eat whatever food I scrounged up at 11 at night while watching Unsolved Mysteries. And then if it ended in a ghost story, I had to wait and do something else before I could go to sleep. Like if it ended with a ghost story, I was done.
Yeah. So yeah, me too.
Out of curiosity, how often did it end in a ghost story?
It feels like all the time, because that's what, you know, that's back in the olden days, that's what sticks in my memory about Unsolved Mysteries was, like, if I think back to segments that I really just remember, it's the ghost ones, which is ridiculous because I don't believe in ghosts, but whatever.
Yeah, I'm like half believe them, half don't. But anytime, like if I watched The Haunting on Hill House or anything like that, I'm up all night. It gets me. Actually, so Unsolved Mysteries, I also remember from my youth. Is this something that you watched, Rolando?
No, I'm actually not a big fan of true crime. Like, well, hang on. Wow. I'm not a fan. All right, hang on. Let me rephrase that. I actually do like true crime, but I like more the exploration of the criminal justice system, not necessarily unsolved mysteries.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
So like something that has kind of like a happy end, maybe?
Not necessarily. I think, so for example, I think one of my few forays into true crime was like Serial, right? That podcast.
Yes, of course.
And I argue that that podcast isn't necessarily just about the true crime element. It's also about the, how do I say? It's also about the criminal justice system, right? Like, what is guilt in a crime, in, you know, in a court of law? And, you know, that one didn't necessarily have like a happy ending, right? Because as far as I'm concerned, like, I think there is justifiable cause for him, Adnan Syed, not to necessarily go to jail for this crime, but I'm not necessarily saying that he's guilty or not guilty. I'm just saying that there isn't enough probable cause. I guess from a young age, I guess I never liked like this kind of programming because We'll talk about it as we go along, but this kind of program was never something I kind of was drawn into and stuff. But interesting shows, like watching some of these old ones. They're available on Hulu. Did you guys know this?
Unsolved Mysteries?
Yeah, Unsolved History is available on Hulu at the moment.
Oh my gosh! I know they're on Amazon Prime because that's where I usually watch them. But yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting. So they're many places. Mm-hmm.
I was watching them on YouTube for no reason. These bad bootlegs. Okay. Well, so I'm actually glad you brought up Serial because that's kind of one of the reasons why I think we have this, among other reasons, we have this new reboot. But let's go back to the original Unsolved Mysteries. It came out and debuted in 1987, and it lasted for 12 seasons up until, I'd say, 2000. And then it got a bunch of different versions. It went over to Lifetime in 2001 for a bit. And then it got a couple years later after that to Spike. But we're going to focus on the original NBC/CBS run. I think the most iconic thing about Unsolved Mysteries is the host. And the host of that show is Robert Stack, who is an actor. But I would argue that at least for my generation, we kind of would just know him from Unsolved Mysteries. Might know him from the movie Airplane. But this is kind of like his gig. And he hosts an hour-long show where he takes you through multiple stories, mm-hmm. not necessarily involving death or murder. And sometimes it has to do with lost love, has to do with alien abductions, has to do with paranormal occurrences, and sometimes just, you know, people being reunited. So it covers a whole lot of stuff within 1 hour. And the show always begins, you know, with a disclaimer to the audience that it's not a news show. That this is a show that has been reenacted, and sometimes they'll get actual people that were a part of the stories to be a part of these reenactments.
You know why they have that disclaimer, right?
I read something like NBC was like kind of disowned itself from it and was like, we do not want anyone to think that this is us and this is us putting out news and claiming that it's news.
Yeah, so it was NBC News that had issue, right? They didn't want necessarily too close to the programming and they didn't want to confuse audience members saying, because, you know, keep in mind, a lot of the format for Unsolved Mysteries was similar to news storytelling, right? You had interviews with patients and stuff. The only quasi area that kind of starts getting into the realm of kind of a fiction is actually the recreations.
Yes. And that's where
very amusing.
Yes. Oh, yeah, for sure.
And they're almost always inaccurate. Almost always. Matthew McConaughey is probably the most famous actor who was in a recreation.
Yes. Really? He was early on, right? I think right before Fear and Loathing.
I think he's probably the most famous actor that we've seen. It's not like Law and Order where we see all the actors. Unsolved Mysteries. I mean, you look at the quality of the reenactments and you're not really that surprised. None of those people became famous actors, but Matthew McConaughey is the standout.
I think that's what's one of the most interesting parts of this show, too, is that it does kind of like cross that line between, you know, documentary and like giving you the facts and then narrative almost to the point where sometimes it feels a little too theatrical. But I also would argue that that's what's so great about it. Especially when I was a kid, it like really, really got to me. I always confused the show when I was a kid, actually, to The Twilight Zone. Mm. Something about Rod Serling and Robert Stack, they just like have the same kind of vibe to me and the way that they introduce the stories.
They definitely do have the same energy, yeah.
Yeah, and some of this, I remember this one Unsolved Mysteries that I actually just revisited because I looked it up, was about this woman who had some sort of UFO encounter and got radiation and it was killing her body and the government wouldn't take responsibility for it. And that right there, like not knowing what it was that you came into contact with, she saw something in the sky, came out of her car, looked at it for 5 minutes, and then after that her body was just like given up on her, and it was confirmed that she had radiation. That feels like a Twilight Zone story to me, you know. So there is kind of this aura around some of these mysteries too that I could see why people would confuse them for narratives and why they had to kind of put that disclaimer at the beginning.
They definitely did a lot of types of mysteries, like you said, and so they'd go into these ghost stories and psychics and paranormal, and then they would have just a straight up murder mystery or a case where they had a fugitive. They knew what they were looking for. You know, they knew who they were looking for. I will say that, you know, I liked the murder true crime segments more, even if the ghost story ones have stuck in my head better. But I did, even growing up, I hated the Lost Loves one, which as an adult, I like those now. But I remember when I was younger, I was like, oh, this is so boring. Who cares? And then, now I'm old enough to know that if you lost your brother, you'd probably want to find him. Like that, I mean, I understand now, but.
Mm-hmm. I mean, rewatching it, some of the early ones, the ones that do stick out are the stories of people being reconnected. And I'm sorry, I'm going to be muting you until you speak just because the reverb. Okay. Yeah, those lost love, like, right? One of the ones that sticks out was this lady who was looking for her twin brothers because their mom died in a horrific accident, and then she's hunting them down and stuff. But it didn't feel like a mystery, which was kind of like throwing me off. Keep in mind, I've never seen the show, but it was just a story about this lady who's reunited with her twin brothers, and now they're searching for their biological father together. And I'm just like, okay. I understand the love that these people must be experiencing being reconnected, but yeah, it wasn't my favorite things.
Well, also, they're kind of short and sweet. They don't really spend more than 10 minutes per segment, it feels like, with the commercial breaks and just having 4 and 5 stories. Sometimes these stories, they just move so quickly that you can't, as an audience member, personally speaking, can't build an emotional connection to it.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, goes to, I mean, that's only the, I feel like, for some of the lost loved ones. I think the murder mysteries, the content itself is so jarring and so dark and ominous that you'll always have the viewer's connection to it. But some of the other ones, I think they need more time. And that was kind of like one of the downfalls of having so much content in like an hour long episode.
Yeah, which I mean, I've watched those 15 minute segments or they're 10 minutes. And then I'm like, I don't know if there's enough content here for a podcast episode. And I research it and then I have a 10,000 word script, you know? So really boil it down to the most interesting elements. And that's how they keep the audience engaged and moving.
Yeah, definitely.
And that is, it's so interesting, right? How they're able to, I find it fascinating that they're able to tell how many seasons this show run, like 12 seasons.
12 seasons.
And then it went on Lifetime for a while and then like
13.
Okay. So 14, yeah. However long it was running for, though, the fact that they're able to create these many stories, and granted, you know, they don't go in depth and stuff. I was still like surprised. Although, again, I agree with Charlie here about the going into the paranormal story. So those don't really necessarily resonate with me because you know me as when we talked about To Catch a Liar, To Tell the Truth, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not a fan of like the paranormal in general. And the very first episode that shows up on Hulu for the first season, first episode was about the hauntings of the Queen Mary, the ship. And it's like a 12 minute segment. I'm just like rolling my eyes because I'm not a ghost story. I'm not a paranormal believer. You know, so yeah, that's my spiel.
Well, actually, one of my other favorite old time shows that have to do with true crime is Forensic Files. And I remember seeing on Forensic Files this episode about, actually, this case happened in New Jersey. And unfortunately, the man's name is escaping me, but he killed his entire family in his house and then he disappeared. And he was supposed to kill himself, but he didn't. And then he went on to lead a life miles away from New Jersey, somewhere in the Midwest, I think. They put it on Unsolved Mysteries, and they actually had a sculpture artist make a sculpture out of what his face would look like.
It's 20 John years. Emil List.
That's right. That's yeah, right.
I know that guy.
A truly disturbing story. Mm-hmm. And they made a sculpt of what his face would look like, and when they aired, someone saw that and said, that looks like my neighbor. And they were able to find him. And that's one of the best things about this show is that this show has actually solved a lot of cases. I think I read somewhere around like a couple hundred.
Oh, I read, this is according to their own statistics apparently, but like over 1,000 reunited family members. Reunited family members. I think half of their fugitive stories resulted in an arrest. And then obviously the paranormal stories are the ones that have been obviously not solved because...
Yeah.
Some would say they're not real.
Yeah.
Some would say. I mean, the level for proof would be quite high. But the one I remember is just this lady was murdered and one of her coworkers, the ghost came to the coworker and told her who did it. And it turned out to be that guy. And that one just really stuck with me. And I keep thinking, I should look it up because I'm sure there is just a very normal explanation, or, you know, the guy was already under suspicion and she had a dream and it's just all coincidence. I don't know, but I really mm-hmm. should look that one up because that one's kind of stuck with me as so mysterious and spooky.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I want to look that one up too. But actually going back to the List family murders, I remember kind of being like so gobsmacked by that. Because for me, I never really thought of unsolved mysteries as anything more than kind of entertainment. So the fact that it actually had a role in being part of like the case and keeping it active and getting it solved to me was just showed one, the power of media, but you know, the power of getting like stories out there and that this is what people will see. People won't like look at, you know, wanted ads or read the news as much, but they will watch a show like this. And that's probably more of a likelihood of you solving something. Which is really interesting, where I just, as a thought, it's such an interesting one about our society.
They did such a good job making the audience believe they had information. So that's mm-hmm. the other thing. We can watch these things, but if we don't believe that we could solve it, we're just going to be really passive. So they have that mm-hmm. whole line, perhaps it's you. You know, perhaps you're the one who can solve this mystery. And yeah. I, you know, the John List case was almost 2 decades cold. He was gone for 2 decades. They put him up on Unsolved Mysteries and there he is. And of course crazy. That led to, you know, America's Most Wanted having the success they had as well.
Yeah, that's true. I remember that.
So in terms of the success rates, right? Because getting an arrest isn't necessarily the same thing as getting an actual prosecution. And
nope,
I think also at the same time, not just the prosecution, but like, I think my fear with sometimes these shows is that the person who might be accused of said crime might not be able to get a fair trial of this. Now, keep in mind, I tried to do research on this topic because this was kind of my stance going into this show. I could not really find any real data on that. That's going to be my journey, right?
As a person, look up the TV show Cold Justice. I did a case on crime lines for Donna Ooh. Matthews. She was, was it Donna? It wasn't Donna Matthews. I got the wrong name. Sorry. I did a case on her, but she was on Snapped, which is a different show. But with Cold Justice, they have had arrests and the people were then found not guilty. And at least 3 of them sued Cold Justice.
Oof.
Or it, wow. Some sued Cold Justice and some sued their local police for basically putting this TV show ahead of an actual investigation. Okay, it's Stephen Fisher and Melissa Gregory are the victims, and they were in Cold Justice. The episode on their case ended in arrest, and the lady was then later found not guilty. But if you watch that Cold Justice episode, because I watched it, she looks pretty guilty. But there wasn't nearly enough for a conviction. So yeah, there definitely, when we're ending these shows with there was an arrest, gives us a sense of resolution that mm-hmm. should not exist because innocent until proven guilty, mm-hmm. which is where mm-hmm. I think that really sounds like your interest right there with more the court side of things and the yes. criminal justice system, which I Insight was mostly an unsolved true crime show. Crime Lines is a mix. So I cover cases that have gone to court. Some have had guilty, not guilty. Some are possible wrongful convictions. Have a possible wrongful conviction death penalty case coming up soon. Sometimes I delve into the legal stuff. It's a lot, though.
Yeah, like, I can imagine. Mean,
I spend a lot of, when I'm researching those, I spend a lot of time reading a lot of really boring affidavits mm-hmm. and appeals documents and stuff like that. But on the whole, those cases are interesting because we have to look at our criminal justice system.
Absolutely. Charlie, actually, do you have a background in law or is it just, is this just purely like interest?
Yeah, it's interest-based. My background is actually as an ASL interpreter.
Oh,
and
awesome.
Sign language and podcasting are completely useless together.
That is
like my deaf friends are like, so glad for your success. I have no idea what you're doing, but okay. I just sign radio and we move on. But so yeah, it's definitely, I went a very different direction.
No, that's fascinating. I think, so this is where as much as, like, yeah, the flaws of the shows that I do have with it, I do think this idea of kind of the viewer, right, kind of getting involved in the justice system, I find it interesting, not necessarily terrifying, because keep in mind, I also grew up with, like, a love of, like, comic books and stuff, and that is all vigilante justice. However, there is, at the same time, like, a dark side that can come with that, right? So it's a balancing act, and, I find it fascinating that you could be so interested enough, right, motivated enough to, like, read these, like, affidavits and these briefs and all that stuff, which would just go over my head, but yeah, like,
yeah, cool, if you're interested enough, it's really crazy how much reading I have to do to prepare to write, like, one paragraph in my script, you know, wow, just to be able to fully understand it so that I can then boil it down. So I tend not to take cases that are too, like, I would normally not do a death penalty case because the appellate side of that is ridiculous. But I did use a researcher who is a defense attorney who works with innocence cases, works death penalty. She helped. I mean, I obviously paid her, but she helped me research that side of things.
The Innocence Project?
Yeah, she does innocence work, but not for the Innocence Project. Okay, okay. That's a whole thing.
Gotcha. Oh, no, okay. No, cure.
Even nonprofits have, like, political things. So.
Oh, I can imagine. But yeah, because, I mean, from what I understand, right, the Innocence Projects will only really take a case, like, if they know they have, like, an actual solid case. Otherwise,
yes, you know? Like, they, a lot of, there are different Innocence Projects, like, so the Innocence Project as itself is an entity, and then there are other similar projects around the country, and it really depends. Some of them will take hard to win cases, but a lot of them will only take cases where DNA is involved, because then you can prove it one way or the other.
That makes sense.
Which is a good segue. DNA evidence. I was only able to see really, like, a big handful of these episodes and stuff, but how often does DNA evidence play a role in unsolved mysteries? Does anyone remember?
I don't know. I don't really remember there being a lot of talk about DNA. It aired the first time, we didn't have the DNA technology we have today. They had DNA, yeah, but they needed, like, a sample. They needed, right, like, a big chunk of your arm to be able to write DNA. Now they can take tiny amounts and duplicate it and get not as accurate results, but results anyway. So I think it may not have factored as much. You would be really surprised at how small the amount of DNA they're using in court today is.
I actually, yeah, no, you're right. It's true.
A little nerve-wracking.
Yeah. So for our audience, right, you guys may or may not have heard this term. Have you guys heard this term, CSI effect?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Nicole?
Yeah. Explain it for our audience.
Okay, so CSI effect is basically the effect that the show CSI had on, like, the general population, like, the general viewing audience, in which they believe that DNA evidence is all around us all the time, always, and we can use it to convict crimes, which is not really the case at all. It's kind of skews how we perceive. So it skews how we perceive, like, the criminal justice system again, right? So let's say you're in a jury. If you're on a jury for a crime, because you've been watching CSI, let's say Miami, right, which was my favorite one, you're waiting for the bombshell DNA evidence to arrive. And when it doesn't, you're like, all right, well, not guilty. You know what I mean? And it just skews the way people will, you know, will juror. Juror crimes.
It is it also cuts the other direction in that a jury will hear forensic evidence that is not that accurate, like hair analysis. The FBI found that 95% of cases with hair analysis, the results were overstated to the jury by the expert.
Wow.
In 95%. They were still looking into about 1,200 more cases when Jeff Sessions cut that whole program, so that's a whole thing. But forensics are not as perfect as we like to think.
Yeah.
And so juries will also be like, oh, well, I mean, the bite mark matched. Well, yeah, okay, a bite mark in an arm which moves, which is fleshy, you will not get an exact match if someone bites an arm. And they're matching it to, like, decomposing bodies. That's not That's not accurate. I like my dream podcast, if I had all the time in the world and time was not an issue, is I would make a podcast where all I did was debunk forensic evidence or put it in context to where you people could understand the actual, like, can you match handwriting? What is the truth about this? And cases where bad evidence convicted people.
That would be an awesome podcast. And they were later exonerated. Yeah, that would be really, really cool.
I know. Yeah. Can you even imagine how much work that would be?
I could. Yeah, seriously. Would not. And I think that would be such a really helpful show, too, for
I think so, too.
TV. Yeah, because, like I said, CSI, even, you know, Law & Order, one of my favorite shows.
Oh, gosh,
dramas,
I love,
right?
Law & Order.
And at the same time, though, it's just like, it's just such a flawed view of, like, how the legal system actually works.
Like, start to finish. Yeah. It is just wrong. But I love that show. Mm-hmm. I know I listened to your Star Trek episode and you talked about Trekkies and then you're like Fletchies, you know, with Murder, She Wrote.
Yes.
When I was growing up, my bedtime was 8:30 and I got to stay up an extra half hour on Sunday nights to watch Murder, She Wrote. Murder, She Wrote, Matlock, Perry Mason. I mean, I watch Perry Mason on reruns. I'm not that old. But like those were my shows. And now I'm like into the really like the darker British ones. And then I just finished one of those like Nordic noir books. I like, that's all I'm into. So when I'm not doing true crime, I'm doing crime fiction. It's nice. Like I'm a one track mind.
That's kind of me. I watch Murder, She Wrote. I read Agatha Christie.
I love Agatha Christie. I have a signed portrait of, I don't know if you've watched the Hercule Poirot with David Suchet. It's like my favorite adaptation. I actually have a framed signed picture of him as Hercule Poirot in my formal living room.
Really?
Oh, very nice.
But we also have a Lego Millennium Falcon on the wall in our formal living room, so formal might be the wrong word for it.
Oh, I love the blending of genres here.
I do. Awesome. I love that too.
My husband and I kind of have like the room split in half, and I have my half and he has his half.
That's us too. And one of the first episodes we ever did was Murder on the Orient Express. I just wanted to say that everybody should go back and listen. You know,
I was like,
we have to do that one. So
when I was listening to your Scooby-Doo episode, I was thinking, I don't know why it popped in my head. I was like, I wonder if they did the Murder on the Orient Express. Did you do the new movie?
We did. We compared the
Kenneth Branagh one.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I was so upset leaving the theater because the movie was so bad.
I
don't know. Is that your opinion?
Nope. We shared the same opinion.
Okay, good.
That's it. Yeah.
I was like, compared you guys are like, delete this audio.
All of us in this chat room here, we agreed. Eddie, right?
Like, it was very disappointing.
Because the original one was so good.
Well, I love the original way that I love the new one, but did like certain scenes of the new one.
Like, if they just turned off the volume, the new one was gorgeous. Like, I loved watching it.
Yes,
it
very visually appealing.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
I think so, too. Yeah, there was some beautiful, like, over, like, kind of, like, looking down shots. Really, really nice, but it didn't crack it. And it's getting a sequel, Death on the Nile. So
oh, I love Death on the Nile. Don't ruin that book. That book is so...
It's one of my favorite Hercule Poirot books.
So yes. you mentioned an old episode we did, but you also did mention a future episode that we are going to be doing, which is Perry Mason, which is currently getting it's currently running on HBO, the remake, reboot.
It's a remake.
Yeah.
Okay,
I would say so. We're going to do that in the next couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. So stay tuned.
Okay, I'll have to. I didn't even know they were. I don't watch very much anything because I don't have time because I'm too busy reading about murder, but I do want to. I didn't know there was going to be another Perry Mason.
It is currently airing as we currently. I don't know how many episodes is out right now. But
it looks very, very different from the original, though. Okay. It's like it's got a whole new feel to it. So I'm intrigued.
I'm more intrigued for Tatiana Maslany. I think that's her name. She was from Orphan Black, but she's phenomenal actress, right? And she's like the lead. Opposite of Perry Mason's character, so I'm curious to see how they do her. But anyway, back to Unsolved Mysteries. No.
You guys got me all over like the things I like to talk about, which is Agatha Christie and Unsolved Mysteries. So
passion. That's what we want from our guests, right? And that's what we're getting. I love it.
So flash forward from the last time we got an Unsolved Mysteries, which was on Spike TV, they kind of took some footage of Robert Stack and they re-edited it. And that was the last time we kind of saw anything new of Unsolved Mysteries.
Wait, so, when you say they re-edited it, what do you mean? Like they just took like his footage and kind of like, were they just retelling old episodes or were they?
Yeah.
Okay.
They re-edited it. I haven't seen it, but from my understanding, that's what it was.
I think they put the updates on too, right?
Yeah.
So a lot of times, watching those is really frustrating because you're like, this is such a great mystery. And then they're like, it's solved. And you're like, well, okay, never mind. And it's like every single one is like that.
Yeah, that's how I was watching them on Hulu. That's how they show up, right? Where as soon as the segment ends, they'll be like, update. And they give you like the update of what has happened.
Some of them are very unsatisfying, too.
Interesting, yes.
Actually,
Nicole, I did want to mention something else before we did move on, though.
Okay.
Okay. So this is just me as a minority gay. I was noticing a lot of people who get front and center, though, were predominantly white people. Now, that could have just been by coincidence the episodes that I saw. But I happen to also notice usually criminals tend to be cast on the darker shade. Not necessarily black, but like they tend to skew a little darker tone. And usually these criminals. I mean, one of the ones that comes to mind was this guy who was using his wife as like a human shield when he was like at a standoff with police, and then he comes out and it's like, of course it's a Latino. Why would it be a Latino? So I don't know. Nicole, I mean, you watching this, right? Like, am I just reading too much into it now? Obviously we're looking at it through a different lens, but would you say that was the case? Cause keep in mind, I only saw a handful of these older episodes, so I don't know. I could have just had.
Yeah. It's hard to say. I mean, I haven't watched as many as I would like to properly answer that question, but I do think it was more so like late 80s, early 90s. Mm-hmm. Political correctness wasn't kind of part of the agenda, so they weren't really realizing whose stories they were kind of telling.
Gotcha.
The one thing that I did notice when I watched them was it was a lot of Midwestern stories, and sometimes I felt like the way that the show kind of portrayed them too wasn't necessarily in the most flattering light.
I would agree to that. Yeah.
And that was one of the things that that was one of the things that I was like, I wonder if I'm the only one who's looking into this or not. That sometimes it kind of, there was this one story I'll give this as an example. There's this woman who was being sexually assaulted, and when she was supposed to give evidence about it and tell her story, she did a lie detector, and the lie detector said that she was withholding information. And I don't know, I'm not one to put all my hopes on a lie detector test.
As you should not.
No, not at all.
It is a flawed system.
But every time they'd put surveillance on her, nothing would happen. Every time surveillance would be off, something would happen to her. She'd get sexually assaulted again. And they ruled it as that she had multiple personality disorder. And I just thought it was really interesting because I kind of thought that it was unfair of the show to kind of agree with this diagnosis that she had multiple personality disorder just because they never were able to find this person who may or may have not frightened her in order to not speak. So that was one example that I just wanted to bring up, but that's it. Like the show kind of taken in not the best perspective on its own subjects.
And that was a sexual assault episode, you said?
Yes.
Okay. Charlie, but,
and then she, oh wait, no, actually she,
it, was
it ended with her dying.
Cindy, yeah, Cindy. James. Yeah,
yes,
Cindy,
yes. She died and her body was found bound, and they still believe that she was the one who did it to herself.
Really?
It's a case, let me tell you. It is. It's yes. If you go on Reddit, I mean, people are debating it like crazy.
Yeah.
Still.
Interesting. All right, I want to check this. Oh, I'll check out this story.
So it sounds like this case itself is a mystery. But that was one thing. But actually, you know, portrayal of stories and whose side to take, that's something that I think actually kind of continues into this next one.
You were kind of cut off a little. I'm sorry. What?
Oh, well, I was just saying that, perspective of the filmmakers and the producers and whose story to tell and whose side to take, that's something that's very, I think, prevalent in this new version, the 2020 Netflix reboot of Unsolved Mysteries. I just wanted to set the kind of frame of the last time we saw Unsolved Mysteries about 10 or so years ago to today. You know, a lot has come out within kind of like boosting, I think, the popularity or at least the mainstream popularity of true crime. You mentioned Serial, the podcast.
Yes.
I mean, since that, there have been so many podcasts that have come out. You know, My Favorite Murder is huge. There's so many people who go around, you know, saying whether or not they're a murderino. Are you a murderino, Charlie?
No, I support what they're doing, but they're a comedy podcast first, yeah. True crime second, which is totally fine. But I like a lot more substance to my stories. Like, they'll tell a story and it'll be entertaining, but I'm like, well, what about this? What about this? What about this? You didn't answer any of these questions. And that's why it takes me so long to make my own show, because I'll be like, well, what about this? What about this? What about this? And I'm constantly digging. And so those are the shows I'm drawn to, the really detail-oriented ones.
I wonder if you'll like this or not, but when I was telling people about your podcast Insight, because there were two of you, I was like, it's the anti-My Favorite Murder. They actually go in on detail, and they don't really joke about it. These are the facts. But what were you going to say, Rolando?
I actually had a question, Charlie. I don't know if you mind answering this, but how often do you spend working on an episode?
I spend from starting research to an edited episode is 15 to 20 hours per episode. Wow. And that's just to get one episode out that, you know, obviously doesn't account for social media, marketing, all those other things that I do. And then it's not my only show that I write for. I used to write for, I don't know if you know the network Parcast, but I've written for them before. I've written for other true crime shows, but right now I'm just focusing on my own shows, but there's multiple of them. So, you know, right now Crime Lines puts out 6 episodes a month.
Wow.
I write for Rusty Hinges, puts out 2, and then I do 4 live streams. So, like, live stream podcast episodes. So it's a lot all the time. Now, the live streams don't take me as much time, but the regular episodes do.
Do you think that... All right, so at a certain way, have you become like kind of numb to kind of murder and crime?
I've always had a pretty good boundary. There are a few times I've like had a rough time. I was covering a case of an infant who was abducted at birth while I was pregnant. Not a good idea. I like read the part about like the mother, how she felt like sitting there without her baby, and I like had to put it down. I had to walk away. It wasn't great, but you know, I don't get into gory details. My episodes are much, I don't get into gory details because I feel it's disrespectful to the victims. Like they have lost all privacy and dignity. I can give them a little bit. So the only gory details I give are ones that are relevant to understanding the case, or, you know, the evidence that comes up later in court, or how they caught the killer. So I don't really get into the gory stuff. Other cases I'll walk away from, I'll look into it. Someone suggested I do the case. It was a adoptive child who went through a rebirthing thing to treat her, reactive attachment disorder.
Wait, what is rebirthing? Is that what it sounds like?
Yes. They like wrap her in a blanket, and then she has to kind of, and they hold it, and she had to like fight her way out and be reborn.
Oh.
It's controversial because unfortunately the girl died. They suffocated her in this thing. And then, so then it's the therapist and the adoptive mother and all this legal stuff. And I was like, oh, I think I'll do that. I got like 10 minutes into reading about it. I was like, I can't spend 20 hours with this material. Like, it's just too upsetting. So there are things I'll walk away from. And, you know, I'll read something super, like, graphic and terrible and be okay. And then I'll read something that just hits me. Because we all bring our past into things. So sometimes something will just hit me in a way I can't do it. So
this is a question I'm going to pose to everyone here, right? In terms of this boom that, Nicole, you were talking about for true crime. Do you think this current boom of true crime, does it honor the victims, or do you think you see it more so going the route of dishonoring victims? And I'm talking like the boom that has happened, right? Like, I don't know. What are your opinions?
Honestly, it depends. I would say in my case, it depends. You know, I remember seeing there was a film called There's Something Wrong with Aunt Diane about the woman who, you might have heard this case, she drove the wrong way on a highway and she killed herself and the 5 children in the car. And I felt like that documentary is a really interesting case in general, especially the documentary about like whether or not true crime, kind of our fascination with it currently, goes a little too far. They showed her the crime scene photos of her dead body, which I always feel kind of is drawing a line.
Yeah.
I would say, you know, to me that's disrespectful. And that's a little like almost exploitive. And the film almost was kind of exploiting her family and how it seemed that the family, what I got from that was that they all thought that she was they were all in denial about her alcoholism. Mm-hmm. So that also kind of felt exploitative of the family who lost five precious children and this woman. So I think it depends on who's telling this story. And I think that, I mean, just tying it back to this current reboot of Unsolved Mysteries, I think they could do a really good job at respecting the victims mm-hmm. and not exploiting it in a way that I haven't really seen other current materials do. And that's my opinion.
Charlie? Yeah,
I definitely see it. You have both, but we've always had both. So if you go back to Truman Capote and In Cold Blood, while there are definitely issues with that book and how he put it together, it is taking he's trying to make a nonfiction novel. So it mm-hmm. reads like a novel. It's incredibly amazing. Just Mercy, Tulia, like I can name Devil in the White City. I can name some true crime books that are just elevating because they're so intelligent and so well written. And then you're still going to have your paperbacks. The one I read when I was like 13 was Amy Fisher, Lethal Lolita. You're always going to have your In Cold Bloods. You're always going to have your Just Mercies, but you're always going to have your Lethal Lolitas. You're going to mm-hmm. have the I don't know if you guys swear on your show. You're still going to have the crap. And so
we do.
You're going to have it. And that's what we see on Oxygen and Investigation Discovery. We see the good. Yeah. We see some really great, smart things. And then we see some real crap. Same with podcasting. We have shows that do get really graphic, really gory, really they're going for shock factor. And then you have the shows that are, telling a story and they're trying to help people understand the criminal justice system mm-hmm. like Serial or In the Dark or Accused. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, yeah, we have both. We've always had both, but now we have more of both because yeah. it's just yeah. so much more mainstream.
Yeah.
And Eddie, what about you? You've seen a lot of, I think, true crime documentary because sometimes I'm interested. And then I don't think interestingly enough, we don't necessarily usually finish it, which might say something about us, right? But we do start them. Your thoughts?
So out of all of us, I'm not a very big fan of true crime or shows or anything like that. I mean, I used to just watch Unsolved Mysteries for actually the paranormal aspect of it, the ghost stories and stuff. I felt every other episode was sad because, like the name says, it's unsolved. We don't know what happens. Or at the time I saw the episode, it would be like without a conclusion of the event. But yeah, you get a little bit of both. I think what stood out too was there was a very popular true crime reenactment show on Spanish television. And it all based on women who were abused in some level, and they finally had enough, and they would murder the abuser. So it always be like these innocent women that were like abused, and then finally they just crack one day, and it's like, I'm not gonna take this anymore, and bow.
Oh my god! And we get a remake of this?
Was it wait? Is it by any chance? Was it called Mujer Casos de la Vida Real?
Yes.
Oh my god! Yes. That is easily one of the greatest shows. It deserves like an American remake. Yes, it does.
It's really like a telenovela, and usually in 30 minutes, it's like so concentrated with drama. So, but I remember just like watching it, and I'd be like, "Oh my god, this is so trashy and amazing." But.
Well, that's one word that I would not describe this current Unsolved Mysteries. I'm just going to go back to this new one. It's so different in comparison to the Robert Stack show. And it's interesting because they said that they were going to give it a freshening up.
Mm-hmm.
So they completely removed a host. There is no host for this new version of Unsolved Mysteries on Netflix. Although you do see Robert Stack's face when it says Unsolved Mysteries, if you see
that's you.
That's his phrase. So that was kind of like a nice little tie-in and tribute to him. But the people tell their stories. And then to fill in the gaps, you'll get text, which I think is a nice effect. Sometimes, when you hear other people, it needs to be more direct, like direct cinema. They need to tell their stories. And I think that's a nice effect. And it's one story per episode. And right. it really, they've stated that they really want to just tell people stories and not take a side. And that's something that I kind of believe, and I kind of don't, because it's just, it goes against human nature to not take a side and to not have your own opinion.
So they're on record as saying that they don't want to pick a side in these stories?
Yes.
Interesting. I do documentary filmmaking. That's what I wanted to do for my career-wise. And you just know there's the bias is always going to be there.
Always going to be there.
I think in these instances, the bias is still there because each episode, they tend to, except with the exception of maybe the UFO one, but the episodes where there's a murder or something, they do lead you to believe that there's a suspect, and this is why we suspect this person.
Yes.
And yes. I don't know. I'm just saying, it's just like, if that's rather, if they were trying to go for that, I don't know if they've succeeded. But I'm also I won't blame necessarily the filmmakers on that. I might take this on Netflix, you know, as a whole, because I think that they're usually, so the documentaries that I've seen that tend to be exploitative have been the Netflix documentaries. And I'm talking about like the one Making with Aaron Hernandez. Making a Murder less exploitive. It did have exploitive elements, but I was still, again, exploring the criminal justice system, not necessarily the crime itself. Mm-hmm. The Aaron Hernandez is the one that comes to mind. The Secret Keepers, right? Which is about the nun, the girls.
The Keepers,
Yeah, mm-hmm. The Keepers. Thank you. Yeah. That one, I found that super problematic because it was so exploitive. It really just really goes into the gory details of sexual assault. So I think Netflix tends to be on the sketchier side when it comes to their documentary programming. No shade to them. I actually do respect the fact that they are putting documentary, like, they are giving it a platform, which I think the only other producers that have done that is probably going to be HBO. But think it's still, you know, sometimes when they cross that line, it's a little, I'm not a fan of it, obviously, as a documentary filmmaker.
Yeah, I think in this particular case with Unsolved Mysteries, it's a little toned down compared to some of the other ones, especially, mm-hmm. like, say, The Keepers. There's only 6 episodes, too. I've only watched 3. How many did you watch, Rolando?
4.
Did you watch 5. The first 4 in order? Or?
Eddie, you watched 5.
I watched 5, yeah.
I watched 4. No, I didn't watch them in order. I watched based off of, I don't know, usually the summary. I'm just like, all right, this seems interesting. I did see the first episode, right, which Alonzo's story. Let's talk about a handsome gentleman that... not Alonzo.
Wait. Alonzo was the first Ray guy. Rivera.
Oh, yes, yeah, Ray Rivera was first because Alonzo was... local to me.
Oh, was he?
A couple years ago, the family, through a friend, kind of reached out for me to cover the case because I have another podcast that's on hiatus and probably will be forever, where it's called Impact Statement and I interview victims of crimes. We were going to work on something, but then they were working on a documentary, then they were working on the Unsolved Mysteries thing, and it's very difficult. I think people need to realize one thing when you're doing these documentaries is that you're re-traumatizing the people you're interviewing. So like you said with The Keepers, one of the most problematic elements I had is I was listening to a woman tell her story that she has clearly not healed even the littlest bit from, and they're like, let me put a camera in your face. And I'm like, you know, had she come to me and wanted to tell her story on my podcast, I would have told her no. Because I one time interviewed someone who was clearly not ready to tell her story, and I will never do it again. It was a mess for everybody. Anyway, it was a mess. Anyway, I learned a very valuable lesson that I'm sure people who go to school for journalism learn real fast. Right. But with Alonzo, they didn't want to be telling their story over and over and over again in a short amount of time because it's so draining on them. So then with Unsolved Mysteries coming out to kind of promo it, we talked about me covering the case on Crime Lines. I am surprised they were able to make such a long episode on it. So that's one of the criticisms I'm hearing. It's why I've not covered it on Crime Lines, is there's not a lot of information out there. And I'm even local, so I know all the local gossip, right? Still not enough information out there. So that's one of the criticisms I've heard about this reboot is the first one, they're taking 30-minute long 30 minutes of information and cramming it into 10 minutes with cheesy reenactments, and now they're taking 15 minutes and stretching it out. Did you guys feel that way when you watched it?
So this one, I think, is really trying to get us emotionally invested with the people. They spend a lot of time on backstory, on who these people were, so that you can really like get a sense, not only just like of who they were, but like of sadness for this loss of a human being, which is actually kind of one of the things that I don't know how I feel about it, because it made me really sad, especially in like the first two episodes. The second episode about the boy who loses his mother.
Yeah,
I don't know if you saw the second episode.
Which one was this? The 13 minutes.
The hair salon.
Oh, woman. The hair salon. Okay.
And another you one really that I think go was into a little detail. Biased.
With, like,
that one was, I think, that's my big
that
example
one felt a little
of
bit all the, it's just like, this is, here's a spotlight. This is who we suspect.
Yes.
I'm like, I really want to know, like, they have to have had hours of interview footage with him, and this is what they chose to put in there.
Yes.
So you are always having a bias when you're choosing what to include and what not to include. So
yes.
I read an article that they did. They had like a lot of like, what they say, creepy moments with him that they didn't include.
Oh, and, interesting. And, they're like, we have more
and,
in our defense.
Especially
we
they didn't
more.
Mention that he remarried too.
Yeah. Yeah. So. I read that they didn't want to put
oh,
her.
They didn't.
In,
they didn't
in
mention
the,
that.
No, they
I
mentioned
see.
That. Yeah. They include his wife. You know, and they went with, she wasn't around at that time. She wasn't around. Okay. She wasn't part of
yeah,
that
she can't
story.
Contribute
that's,
to that.
That's too. Fair. All right.
Yeah. But I guess back to it. Well, I mean, with that one, it made me really sad because, you know, you really get to spend like a time with her son, what happened to him, like who he was before and what happened to him after and how it's impacted him now. And, you know, you put the camera there and you let it run and you don't edit out when they're choking up and stuff. It's really hard to watch. And that's something that this one does a lot of in comparison to the original. The original didn't really, it didn't have time for that. It had to keep the story moving in between commercial breaks. This one doesn't have commercial breaks. They are almost an hour long. Mm-hmm. They run from like 45 minutes to an hour. So they stay on these moments.
So interesting. All right. So full disclosure, guys, I do work for a company that does like kind of these reenactment documentary style videos. Mostly for pharmaceuticals, right? We're doing commercials. They're like just glorified pharmaceutical commercials. But we take real patients who share their story. I happen to know from experience, you film a lot. And you're always going to just make sure you keep the best parts. And my producer, my head producer, my boss, he always, if they cry, we're making sure it's going to be there on the front page. So I can be very cynical when I'm watching these kinds of things, because I know from an editing standpoint, from a production standpoint, it's just like, this can all just be like just clever editing tricks, right? I tend to be very cynical when I'm watching these things. So I have no reason to doubt him, right? The kid who did lose his mom. But I also have no real reason to doubt his father when he said he was a problem child, because, you know, single mom, new marriage. You know, kids tend to act up. So who's telling the truth? Now, he did show some problems in terms of kicking his son out, like the moment the mom went missing. But
yeah,
I don't know if that's exactly what happened or if that's just how it was kind of the phrasing kind of maybe got lost in translation a little. You know what I mean? Like I actually seem to doubt that it was so instantaneous. But I wasn't there. I don't know. This could be an editing trick where you just took the wrong phrase. You know, you're just putting in the phrase to kind of imply it without saying it directly.
That's the thing, because now immediately I'm going to be like, well, he also openly admits in the edit of this show. So it's all, you know, we could thank the editor for this. But he says, you know, it's good that I have her ashes and that the son doesn't have the ashes and that the son will never see the ashes. They do not belong to him. They belong to the husband.
And but keep in mind, he didn't say those weren't the words he said.
Yes.
You're
and that's the thing. Like, and well, also the editor could have been like, I'm going to take this moment where he says, and that's a good thing. And I'm going to put it here right after him saying, I have the ashes.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
which is that's wrong. But they could very well be doing that.
They did that in the Jinx. The Robert Durst documentary.
Mm-hmm.
It's so famous because they got him on this hot mic moment where he goes, what the hell did I do? Killed them all, of course. But that's not what he said. He said those sentences reverse order, and there's a bunch of lines in between them. So when he said, you know, he said killed them all, of course, kind of out of context, then later when he says, what the hell did I do? He was talking about doing the interview. And it came out in court when they had to release the transcript, because he's on trial, that they edited it to make it sound like he said, "What the hell did I do? Killed them all, of course," which he did not say. And this is this hot mic moment. This was their like bombshell end mm-hmm. of the series, and they fabricated it. And they said, yeah. "Oh well, it's the spirit of what he said." And I'm like, "No, but it's not what he said.
It's not what he said.
It's not the spirit of what he said."
I don't remember now. Did he get convicted, or is he still free?
No, he's in pretrial detention. He's actually on trial right now. They had to pause it due to COVID.
Okay.
And it's supposed to start again this month, but they've delayed it just mm-hmm. constantly because he's in LA where the cases are crazy.
Right.
So I'm not sure when he'll be back in court. Okay. But yeah, the trial's ongoing, but they hit a pause button in March.
Yeah. And that's a prime example right there where the media is skewing things. And as you know, as a content creator, like, and someone who tries to do like documentary filmmaking, I think it's always such a dangerous thing when, you know, especially nowadays, when, not to get political, but we have a president who's saying it's just like all media is fake. You know what I mean? It's a dangerous thing when there are actual circumstances, actual like proof that sometimes that we do fabricate things. Right. So,
I just covered Robert Durst in two parts for my podcast, focusing on the victims rather so much on him. And it was the first time I had heard that those words were manipulated. And I kind of resent the fact that they made me defend Robert Durst on my podcast because I think he did it. Like, I'm not going to pretend I don't. I think he killed his wife. I think he killed her. I think he killed more. I think he killed them all. Like, just like he said. But they made me defend him because, I think he did it, but not because of that, because that was wrong. I think after looking at everything outside of the jinx is why I think this. That if you want to talk about problematic documentaries, that is definitely pretty high up there.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Sorry, Nicole, but I'm just saying, it's just like, so yeah, I felt sympathetic towards him. Sure. I think I was watching it with Eddie, and Eddie was also kind of just like, this poor kid, but I'm always thinking, he's just like, what's left on the chopping block? I just want to just make sure.
Yeah, right.
You know?
No, for sure. I mean, the Alonzo episode starts off with her crying, the mother crying, and then mm-hmm. it goes into the theme song. So, you know, I'm an editor too. I'm already like, oh, you're starting it good. Mm-hmm. You know, like you're going for tears. You're going for
right
like
for
the,
it.
Yeah. And that's what I'm personally kind of torn because I'm like, I really want to see the footage. I really want to see like the unedited raw footage. And I want to know how much of like this editor is messing with me, you know? Mm-hmm. But that's just me thinking as an editor.
So, and back to the Alonzo story just for a little bit. I think I'm going to mute you again, Eddie. Sorry. I muted the wrong person. One of the things that I find fascinating about it is one of the things that I would have wanted to see was kind of seeing Alonzo's mom interacting with the white kids that took him to the party. Because I think that would have been also, there must be so much pain that she's going through. And, like, I know the show was doing a job not to blame these kids because, you know, when you're kids, you're going with whoever to a party, it happens. I think that's a moment that could have been caught on camera, like having the kids kind of explain their side to her, because I'm sure she must have a lot of blame, put the blame on them, right? They took him to a party and they left him there. And I have to believe that it's just like she must be so bitter about, I would be, like, if that was my kid, you know what I mean? So it was just a missed opportunity. But then again, I'm also, you know, that might take away from the spirit of the show. As a filmmaker, I'm looking at it, and I would have wanted a moment between the mom and the kids that took Alonzo to the party, because I can only feel like how much blame she puts on them.
Yeah.
But again, it might have would have taken away from the spirit of the show, which is the unsolved mystery aspect, not like the closure.
And kind of the so-called neutrality of it, because it kind of, you know, this is a terrible thing to say in some regards, but it's kind of like, you know, putting them in a ring and just letting them at it. Like, it's kind of, it's not the show's responsibility to kind of do those things. It's more so just to deliver the facts, which I really hope it does. Because I did feel like it was biased. Like, you know, it's like you're giving me the facts about this woman who in a 13-minute window disappeared, but you're pretty much telling me that it was the husband. So it's like, especially because we have two witnesses who saw her and that 13-minute window, and it looks like it couldn't have been him based on his receipts and everything, but the show is really implying me to that because it just decided we're going to show you the fact that he sleeps with her ashes and all of this extra weird stuff that they decided to keep in.
So one of the things I had to ask you guys from watching the show, do you think when they're planning these episodes, right, are they looking for victims that are going to capture well, obviously, on camera, right? Because let's be real, very first episode, Ray, beautiful, tall, dark man, and it's just like, okay, I see. The episodes that I was watching, right, like there tend to be more attractive people front and center. And it's something that I also tended to notice also on the original run of the show, where they tend to be more what we would perceive as conventional beauty, right? And not necessarily that these people are gorgeous, knockouts, but I'm thinking that there is always, the American public is always going to view pretty people in a better light. And so I think that when, as a producer, do you think that they were going out of their way to kind of cast these kinds of stories that have like some of those features, right? Like Ray, Alonda.
100%. Yeah. I'm really impressed that they decided not to just go with all white victims, which, I mean, if you look at what Dateline covers 2020, most of the victims are pretty and white. And it's this concept of a sympathetic victim. So they're not going to have a criminal background. They're not going to have, if they have skeletons in their closet, they're going to be youthful missteps. You know, they're going to recast it because they're casting a character that's, I mean, there is an entertainment factor to get people to watch. So they are providing you with a sympathetic victim. And so, yeah, I think they absolutely went out of their way for it. You know, when we look at Alonzo Brooks, they're saying, oh, look, small town Kansas, and it's a black guy. Well, I'll tell you 100%, people are going crazy online. It's not that racist out there.
Oh. Okay,
look, I live not that. So I live in Kansas City. I live in an incredibly diverse area. We do not live out in the white suburbs like everybody else. But Kansas City is incredibly segregated. You have Kansas City and then all white suburbs. Like there's not, the fact that he moved from like Topeka to Gardner, I was like, he just moved from like one white city to another. Like that's, and so, you know, one of the things that comes up with these, with the bias, is people don't necessarily watch it the way you're watching it. They're not watching it critically, and they're not thinking, what are they not showing me? And then they get on Facebook and they say, I can't believe this person killed his wife. I can't believe these kids left Alonzo there where people were using racial slurs. Well, of course, people use racial slurs out here all the time. You know, so he may not have felt that threatened because it wasn't that unusual of an experience. And I think when white people, I say this as a white person, get online and we see everything through our own filter.
We see
everything through this. We're like, oh my goodness, they called him the N-word. Like, I'm sure he's heard it before. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, you know, stop clutching your pearls. His friends left him there. They clearly didn't feel he was in that much of a risk, which obviously he was. And I do believe what happened to Alonzo was likely racially motivated, even if it was a secondary factor, because there's that theory that he was flirting with the wrong girl. Yeah, I mean, okay, flirting with the wrong girl and you're black. I mean,
yeah, and from a filmmaking standpoint, right, way to stir that pot of bringing in almost a Emmett Till kind of comparison right there, right?
Yeah, like,
right.
Yeah.
Like, as soon as they brought in the girl thing, he's black. It's just like, okay, I see what you guys are doing. I see it. But as you said, you're right. I'm looking at it from a critical point of view because we're doing this podcast, but also because I study filmmaking and media communications. But they did open up that case, right? The Alonzo case has been reopened.
It was reopened in June. And the FBI believes something happened because they're offering a huge reward. And they're not doing that if they think it's an accident. It's like a $100,000 reward for any information that leads to an arrest. Damn. Not even a conviction, an arrest. So clearly they think there is someone to be arrested. But, you know, there are some people who are like, oh, he probably got drunk and fell in. And I'm like, that's not the Mississippi. This is like a creek. I don't think people are really understanding that aspect of it. But yeah, I think one of the problematic things with any of these investigation discovery shows, podcasts, people hear it and they think they're getting the whole story.
Yes.
And even with my podcast where I just did 2 hours on Robert Durst, there are still things I had to leave out because they don't fit. Or and maybe they would change someone's mind. They didn't change my mind. They didn't. They were minor to me. They might be major to someone else. And we think we know more than we do. And then, of course, we think we can judge people's reactions. We think we can judge if they're being genuine or not. And research shows we cannot. We're terrible.
I 100% agree. I also think that not only were they picking what you, like you say, Rolando, kind of pretty people, I think they were nice and diverse with their choices. But I think they were purposely going for episodes that could, quote unquote, break the internet. Like with how Ray Rivera, he fell through a ceiling. And how did he do that? But then that note behind the computer, the internet's going crazy over what that note meant. The woman, you know, the internet's going crazy over her husband, Alonzo. The internet's going crazy over this theory that he was in a freezer. And then after the police were done with their search, they dumped the body. Like, so many, it's just things that, like, get people involved playing their own kind of detective game. I think they really want people to be a part of that.
The note inspired me to, like, start leaving these random notes around the house. In the event, God forbid, anything should happen to me, I could just... people can find it and be like, there's a mystery to be solved.
Well, the very first case that we did on Insight, the episode's not even available anymore, is on a case of Lori Erica Ruff. And it was a woman who took her own life. And when she did, they found out she was living a lie that wasn't her real identity. They ended up finding her through genealogy matches. But when they went into her house, she had all these notes with all the stuff written everywhere, and they put them online and everyone's trying to decode it. Turned out she was just not mentally well. She was unstable, and she was writing stuff. And the internet spent so much time deciphering this because armchair detectives, I'm including myself in this. We like solving things. We like ciphers. We like a good clue. And even with picking cases for my podcast, if I hear there's a case that has a really great clue and the clue is the hook, I mean, that bumps it up on my list because I know it's going to be interesting for me to research. Mm-hmm. It's going to be interesting to my audience to listen to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I have a question then for everyone. With this oversaturated market that we have of true crime in all forms of media, do we think that this reboot was needed? Ooh. Does it bring anything new to the table? You know, like, why did this happen? Do we think it should have happened? Anybody?
I'll go first. So I thought it would be a stern no going into it, but watching these is actually like, I think the camera work and the way they did the reenactments is a level of production value that it just provides that I was kind of here for. Don't get me wrong. I do miss like those cheesy reenactments. Those cheesy reenactments are so good. Like,
I miss Robert
Stack.
They're
so good to watch. And you know what? Yes, I do miss Robert Stack. I actually started watching, in prep work for the podcast, I actually started watching the older episodes first, which is usually the opposite of how I work. Everyone who listens should know by now. Yeah. I always watch the new stuff first and go back. But Robert Stack, I don't know, his delivery, him standing in front of like that newsroom where people are just running around in the background, like all that, just kind of gives this show like a, I don't know, a cheesy quality that I was here for. And this show is so polished and so clean that I don't know. I don't know if necessarily it needed the Untold Mysteries moniker.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But I don't know. I'm not against it. I was against the UFO story because I was just like, all right, well, I'm not a fan of paranormal stuff, and I'm just like, what? The stories that I had watched up to that point were pretty compelling, like, kind of mysteries. They, you know, I think they did lead you to believe that there was a person to blame, usually. But for the most part, the UFO one was kind of the outlier, in my opinion, because it's these, I don't know, handful of people in the
Berkshires.
Talking about, like, alien abduction and stuff, and... It just made me think of, actually, anyone see the SNL skit with Kate McKinnon and Ryan Gosling? That's what I was thinking of throughout watching this whole segment.
It's a pretty funny skit.
I was hoping for Kate McKinnon's character to just show up and kind of start talking about their alien abduction theory. But I don't know. I found myself like liking the show despite the fact that I think shows like this sometimes are dangerous because of... I mean, are you guys familiar with Cultivation Theory?
No.
No. Okay, so cultivation theory is a mass communications theory in which what happens is all the crime that like local news or TV magazines like put out lead people to believe that there is a higher level of crime all around them that the world seems almost blind to, right? And only they know because they're watching TV. I'm definitely mangling up this theory, but I'm giving you guys a summation of it. And obviously, local news is not responsible wholly for it, but like they're one of the main causes of it. You know the saying, right? If it bleeds, it leads.
It bleeds, it leads.
It's because of that. And the other part of cultivation theory that's kind of scary, it's which affects the law and order justice system, is the fact that because of shows like America's Most Wanted and Unsolved Mysteries, people believe there's actually more cops out there in the world and law enforcement than there are. I think you're more likely to believe that there's like, you're skewed to believe there's like 5-6% of the population is all involved in law enforcement when it's really, I think, less than 1%. Right. And it's those numbers that kind of skew our perception of what's going on in the real world. Right. So I happen to be a firm believer that sometimes media productions like this tends to be a little on the dangerous side, because I also happen to be a firm believer that like most people don't look at stuff critically. And, you know,
yes,
that's the reason I happen to like fiction, because fiction is fiction. And if you're someone who ends up believing in the fiction, that says more about necessarily maybe society and yourself than it does the actual work of art that should be taken at fiction value. So,
well, we have, I don't know if you, I follow Ice-T on Twitter because I follow a lot of people, but he was putting things out about defund the police, mm-hmm. which is the nicest thing he's ever said about cops in his life. And he's saying like defund the police and Black Lives Matter. And people are like, I can't believe you're taking this stance, because they think he is Detective Tutuola from SVU. And I'm like, you guys, rewind a little, listen to his music. You got to go get the special signal, because they had to take it off the album because of all the protests over his cop killer song. Like, what about Ice-T makes you think he's not pro Black Lives Matter, pro defund the police, but people have taken this fiction? And that makes me wonder, like you said, how many people think there's a detective squad of 6 people investigating one rape? That's not happening. You're lucky if a detective will call you back, right? There's no SVU. It doesn't exist. But kind of, so back to just the question about, did we need Unsolved Mysteries? I really like the new documentary style, because this is what I like to watch. I like documentaries that use on-screen text. They don't have a narrator. I think if they brought a narrator in, they'd have the same problem Forensic Files is having right now, where people are mad that it's not the old narrator. Which, of course, obviously is not possible when people die. But apparently we're supposed to find clones. That said, this isn't Unsolved Mysteries. I feel like they put a title on it to get people to watch, but they didn't make Unsolved Mysteries. They made a whole new show and called it Unsolved Mysteries, which is fine. It's, I mean, they own it, right? That's how this works. They can put anything up under that name. It's not Unsolved Mysteries. Like, it's not, I can think of so many ways they could have used this documentary style, did shorter segments, shorter, kind of gave it back that feel, did, I don't know, more shots of the woods, of dark alleys. I don't know what it needs, but it doesn't feel like Unsolved Mysteries, and I think it's going to disappoint the people who wanted it to be.
Yeah, yeah. It's definitely missing, like, there's kind of this kitsch factor in the original Unsolved Mysteries, you know. Maybe it was just Robert Stock himself, or maybe it was kind of like the rush and just like just the facts, 15 like 5-minute segments about it. The other stuff that wasn't just about murder, you know, having multiple stories, it's definitely like its own property. It's a good property. I agree with you 100%. I'll say, for me, I think it's, and this is kind of like a really simple yes, it's needed simply for those people whose stories are being told about the people that they've lost. The fact that the original was able to help solve in their own ways some of these cases, or at least reopen them, you know, it gives me hope that some of these stories will have those kind of endings for them. And I think that that's just like kind of worth it in itself. But from a media landscape, I don't think it should have had this name. But nonetheless, that's I think the only way that people would have watched it is under the name Unsolved Mysteries. Although true crime is so popular now that you put out anything, people will probably watch it. But
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I will say to your cultivation theory, that is super true because, like, you know, anytime my girlfriend leaves the house and she goes to New York City, I'm like, okay, you have to text me every single step of the way. If you don't text me past 9 p.m., are you okay? Like, that stuff has made me think that people are out there ready to pounce on her. So.
Cultivation theory, like, it explains why people can be so scared. There's another theory, actually, that explains why people are afraid of, after watching TV, I forgot the actual name of it, but mm-hmm. Cultivation theory is, like, usually the one that people use in terms of explaining, like, why people believe there's, like, actual, there's more crime than there really is. And, you know, I'm not just blaming, like, shows like just Unsolved Mysteries, right? I, you know, the 24-hour news cycle also has a heavy hand in why that is.
For sure.
So, I want to ask one thing. What do you guys think of the fact that Netflix dumped apparently their evidence onto Reddit so that way the armchair detectives themselves can, like, go out and solve some of these mysteries? Like, how do you guys feel? Ethical, unethical, weird marketing gimmick?
It happens. They're out there. Armchair detectives exist. People are going to do this, period. So why not give them the platform for it, and why not be involved and, you know, have Netflix's name on it? Mm-hmm. I mean, at the end of the day, looking at just from a business standpoint, it's good business. If it's inevitable, I don't know. To me, it is what it is.
Charlie?
I haven't looked at how much they have released, but a lot of information is public record. You can just file your own Freedom of Information Act request. I've done it. I've gotten things from police departments that I can use that haven't been published elsewhere. They're public record, so they can be published, just no one else was looking into it. That can be a little bit problematic in the sense that you are then an arm of the police department to an extent, because they mm-hmm. have discretion over what they release mm-hmm. for the most part. So I did a FOIA request and I got it partially fulfilled because it is an unsolved case. They sent me some of the case file and they sent me everything they had on one suspect with hardly anything about him redacted. And then, like, no one else. And I'm like, mm-hmm. well, so if I was Netflix putting something together and that's what the police gave me, the story I have to tell is of one suspect. So so I don't know what Netflix is putting out there, but I do think we need to remember in unsolved cases that the police control what they release and what mm-hmm. and to a degree that controls the media. So I just want to put that out there.
That's very so true. I didn't even think about that, right? Like, the fact that you're right, like, you're only getting the evidence that, like, will be released by the authorities. So
yeah, that and they said that in the second episode, you know, they said that there's actually a lot of stuff that they aren't releasing, that because they think that, what did they call it, like, if they release it, that means that the person who is guilty, they yeah. can, like, bring up this like in conversation or something. I forgot what that was.
I forgot the term also, but I know they use a line in Law and Order SVU where someone says a detail that only the person who committed the crime
right.
knows.
Yeah. Yes.
I forgot what it's called.
That's how J.B. Fletcher solves all
yeah,
of her
they
murders.
Always,
so.
I mean, they always have hold back information because they do. You would be, people confess to things all the time. And so mm-hmm. they do always have that hold back information. I had a recent FOIA request that was for a nonviolent crime for a robbery denied because they're still investigating it. So if it's an open case, they can deny your request outright or they can choose what they release. And I think that's important to know.
That is super important to know.
It is. And something I'm critical and I didn't even think about that. Like, that's something that just never would occur to me. It's just like, of course, like that. You need to, like, ask someone for this information, and they're yeah. only going to give you what they can or allowed to or want to give you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the person you appeal your, if you get denied or you get partially denied and it goes to review, well, it goes to the state attorney general. So, I mean, basically, the police themselves, right? Mm-hmm. So that's how the FOIA requests, if you want to really overturn it, you have to go to court. I'm not going to court over. You know, in a podcast yeah. episode, I'm dedicated, not that dedicated. So, yeah, there's so it's it's interesting. I mean, that definitely controls what Netflix can put, or what Unsolved Mysteries can put together and what they can release.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, didn't.
Well.
Went over my head, see?
So you need to write to law enforcement more often. To whom it may concern.
I'm going to start having, I'm going to write them. It's just like, I want everything, every crime that was related to the release of this movie. Because sometimes the movie itself, sometimes the movie themselves are the crimes. Yeah. I would say Charlie's.
You're like, I would like to file a report.
Yeah.
Murder on the Orient Express. I want my $8.50 back.
Yes.
Yeah, that's robbery. Yeah.
That is robbery.
That was good. Yes, yes, yes. Nicole, I'm going to let you do the sign away so that way, because you brought in our guest. So.
Awesome. Okay. This has been really enjoyable and so informative. I actually feel like I've learned so much from you, Charlie. Thank you so much for joining us today.
I am so glad you asked me.
Ah, awesome.
Yeah, no,
so
Charlie,
can
thank you
tell...
so much. Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
I'm just saying, thank
you.
Go
for it.
Oh, my God. Awesome. No, you were.
Next time you have murder to talk about, just give me a call. I'm available.
Hopefully they'll do Murder, She Wrote. Yeah. I'm waiting on a Murder, She Wrote reboot because I am all over that.
But are you really waiting for one?
No, I mean, it's going to be horrible.
Yeah, for the sake of the podcast, we'll sacrifice.
Just to talk about Angela Lansbury. But so thank you so much again, Charlie. Tell our audience where they can find you, your Instagram handle and everything.
Yeah, just search Crime Lines Podcast everywhere. Search for it in your podcast app. If you like your true crime a little bit lighter, I write for a podcast called Rusty Hinges that my husband is the narrator for, and it's more historic true crime and lots of dad jokes in there. So I definitely recommend checking it out. So Crime Lines and Rusty Hinges. Yeah, we have lots of kids. We have lots of practice with terrible jokes.
And you actually, out of curiosity, you said you've written for a Parcast. What shows have you written for?
With Parcast, I wrote two historical figures. That was kind of my training. Oh. I wrote for Crimes of Passion and Not Guilty.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah, I listened to a lot of those Parcast ones. So awesome. Awesome. And Rolando, can you tell our audience where they can find us?
Of course. You can find us online at www.remakesrebootsrevivals.com. I don't think there's an and. I don't remember. No, I'm pretty sure it's just Remakes Reboots Revivals. Like, I should know the website, right? Sorry, guys. You can also email us. Our email is remakesrebootsrevivals@gmail.com. Mm-hmm. And you can find us on Instagram and Facebook if you search for Remakes Reboots and Revivals. Yes. And I believe that's it. We're on Twitter, but, you know, we're inactive
a
little bit.
But don't hit us up.
Yeah. So. No. Yeah. The hard truth all of it all.
Awesome. Well, until next time,
stay unoriginal.